Does the Biden administration's approach to antitrust law make any sense? How damaging is it? And is big inherently bad? We'll discuss all this and more on the special sponsored edition of The Editors. Our regularly scheduled programming will return soon. Today's episode is sponsored by the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and I'm joined by Jessica Malugin of CEI, who is director of its Center for Technology and Innovation. Jessica, thanks so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm very happy to be here.
Awesome. All right. So let's do first things first. Who is Jessica Malugin? How did you get interested in this area? What do you do at CEI specifically? Give us a little picture.
Yeah. So I run the tech programming and a lot of the antitrust at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And, you know, how I got here is probably a question for therapy, but I enjoy defending free enterprise. And I suppose I do it on these particular issues because 1 million years ago, I wrote my honors college thesis on the Microsoft antitrust trial. So what
and
that qualifies
you're not a fan?
I was not a fan. And many people would think I should have grown and matured and hardened in that since then, but I still remain skeptical of the effort. So I think what that qualifies you to do is work on antitrust and tech in a public policy outfit in Washington, D.C. So here I am.
There you go. All right. Awesome. So obviously, the Federal Trade Commission has a huge footprint in this area. So let's go real basic. What is the Federal Trade Commission and why do we have one?
The FTC is brought to you, like so many bad things, by Woodrow Wilson. He campaigned on it in 1912. He signed it into law in 1914, and it opened its doors in this month of 1915. And it's on one side, it's kind of the number one consumer protection cop, but it also has on the other side that it does antitrust. So, you know, it kind of followed a little bit of a delay after the 1890 passage of the Sherman Antitrust Act, kind of the OG of antitrust, the Sherman Act. But the Sherman Act is notoriously vague, so restraints of trade can mean a lot of things to different people. And by the time the FTC comes along, we're getting more into the nitty-gritty of what that means in terms of the government's role in patrolling business in America.
So was the Sherman Antitrust Act itself a mistake?
If you look back at the actual, I think that it, you know, it's understandable for its time, but it was a product of its environment. You know, you kind of had the rise of these big trusts and companies, and that was, I think, upsetting and nerve-wracking for Americans. That was a big shift in how businesses ran, and I think that made people worried, and once again, we were faced with, well, Congress should do something, and that's what they did. And because that was the environment here, that's why you have other competition laws around the world are called competition laws. And our competition laws are called antitrust laws, even though they encompass a lot more than trusts. So I don't think it was a great idea, but I think it was, like a lot of things, a product of its political time.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never really think about that. But every time we say antitrust, we're using trust in that 19th century sense, right? We don't really talk about trust now, except for when we say antitrust law, right?
Yeah, it's just sort of a old verbiage left over from how it started. And, you know, even if you look back at what Standard Oil was doing, which was kind of the impetus for this, by the time that case was in court, they were lowering their prices to consumers. So the crux of the question here was born very at the very beginning.
Okay, so we have an administration that's very aggressive in this area, and what antitrust law is or should be is very much in contention and driving what they're doing. So let's, again, just to sort of set the foundations for the rest of our conversation, what was the understanding of antitrust law prior to the Biden administration arriving?
Yeah, so it's always been the source of controversy, what exactly it means. And if you can think about it at the beginning as being a question of who is it designed to protect? Is it designed to protect smaller competitors against these, at the time, big trusts? Or is it designed to protect competition itself, which we can extrapolate competition benefits consumers? So in the first couple years, antitrust is pretty quiet. And then you have kind of a resurgence of interest in this. And from about the 1930s to the 1970s, it's very confusing what antitrust is. And the courts really grapple with what do these statutes mean in terms of practical application. And so you see strange things happening that certainly benefit smaller consumers, smaller competitors, but not necessarily consumers. So the best example is a now much forgotten company called the Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company. And back in the day when they were at their height, which is probably 1940s, they were the biggest retailer in the world. They would dwarf Amazon and Walmart now, not even close.
Literally the biggest in the world?
Yeah, the biggest in the world. And how they became big was that we used to have in this country kind of a million little corner markets, like bodegas is what you would mm-hmm. call them now, and they're very much back in fashion, and I believe you can view the cats that live in them on social mm-hmm. media.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I find, though, when I say bodega, and you know, I'm someone who lived in New York for years and years, a lot of people in the rest of the country have no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah, because I think New York is one of the last places they survive, right? Just the density makes them make sense. Mm-hmm. But that used to be your grocery store, was these little tiny independent grocery stores. And that was great for some reasons, but it wasn't great in terms of lowering prices and a large selection of nutritional choices. So the founders of A&P came along and they figured this out, and they started basically the world's first grocery store chain. And they got really good at collecting data about what people liked in different regions and catering to them. And because they were able to buy in bulk, they passed those savings along to consumers. And they mm-hmm. greatly enhanced the consumer experience of grocery stores in the U.S. But they also made a lot of independent grocery store owners very, very angry. Mm-hmm. So you see a big reaction to that. And one of the things, a great example of how confusing antitrust was in the middle of the 20th century, was you have the Robinson-Patman Act that said, we're going to actually intervene to protect the lesser competitors. So what that meant in practice was a bunch of restrictions on what A&P could do, and what it meant for consumers was higher prices. And so that sort of started the wheels turning in a lot of economists' minds about, well, what are we here to do? And so by the time you get into the 1960s, that kind of thing was really being questioned. And famously, Justice Stewart said in the Brown Shoe case, which was a case about shoe stores merging that would have produced a firm with a 5% share in shoes that was blocked, the justice said the only thing he could deduce about antitrust law was that the government always wins. So it went back and forth between saying, are we worried about consumers and competition? Are we worried about what the market shares are in a market which is called the structural approach? Are we worried about protecting small businesses? And it was just really kind of a mess. And that uncertainty wasn't good for business. And a lot of times it wasn't good for consumers.
Yeah. So then I imagine you're going to say the name Robert Bork somewhere along here.
I am. Yes, he's earned it. So then you have, in the 70s, you have Robert Bork writing the famous antitrust paradox, where he wrestles with those questions. You know, what were these laws intended to do? And he was at Yale, but this kind of took hold in Chicago. So there's the Chicago School of Antitrust. And the two major things to come out of that were, A, that the consumer is at the heart of this. So the consumer welfare standard comes out of this and says, you know, we don't really have a problem unless it hurts consumers. We're not going to worry so much about the competitors, because that's a secondary issue. But the lodestar of antitrust is going to be consumer welfare. So that means what's happening with the prices they pay, what's happening with the innovations that they get to enjoy. And the other thing that comes out of that school is economic analysis. So looking at each case and saying, well, what are the real practical effects here? Not just, you know, we don't like this kind of arbitrary percentage of market share or whatever, but really what is the consumer experience here? What are the economics of this particular case? So that was sort of a revolution in thinking. And then you had, at that time, also the FTC had gotten kind of out of control on its other side of consumer protection, and it was going after children's cereal brands and targeted advertising to kids on Saturday morning. And the Washington Post was calling it the national nanny. And Congress actually in 1980 shut down the FTC for a couple days and withheld reauthorization funds and basically said, you guys have just gone way too far, you're way intrusive. So those two things kind of happen at the same time, right? There's this revolution in antitrust thinking and that there's kind of overreach by the FTC and the consumer protection side. So that's how you have a lot of reforms happening during the Reagan administration at the FTC and in the courts. The courts started adopting these new ideas of antitrust that said, what's happening to the consumer and what are the economics of this case? And that was a real shift. And that approach held for the next 40 or so years pretty successfully in most people's estimation. But here we have now the Biden administration's group at the DOJ, FTC, and for some time in the White House itself, saying that was a failure. There's too much market concentration, and we want to go back to what was before, which is considering lots of other groups besides the consumers, labor, smaller competitors, other issues like that, kind of vague terms and considerations that had muddled antitrust before. We thought we had cleared up, but now apparently we're circling back.
So, Jessica, going back quickly to Bork, so was this area just so murky and so dependent on judicial rulings and administrative judgments that you could just have someone change everyone's understanding of it, and without passing new laws, you have what's happening in practice change as well?
Yeah, I think it just, you know, like we can go all the way back to the Sherman Antitrust Act, where Congress said, I don't know, it's a mess, we got to do something, don't do anything bad. And that was kind of the bulk of the guidance. I mean, there was some update to that when the FTC was created, but not helpfully so. Courts kind of had to decide, well, what's the intent here, and then also what's the good outcome? And that just left a lot of wiggle room and a lot of confusion. I mean, when you have a justice come out and say he doesn't understand it, that's a bad sign.
Right. All right. So the Lina Khan, she's the head of the FTC, and she's been an intellectual leader, right? Sort of the counter Bork, pushing back against his understanding of antitrust. So is the animating idea there that actually, you know, let's not focus on consumers so much, let's focus on big is bad, or am I putting it too simplistically?
No, I think there's a lot of truth in that. That's exactly right. The big is bad is back. That's why they're called neo-Brandeisians. But of course, Brandeis himself was worried about big both in business and government. The neos don't seem as concerned about the government side of bigness. But that's right. They're saying that's just too narrow of a scope, consumer welfare, to guide all of antitrust law. And they're, in Lina Khan's case, specifically makes the point that that's not a good rule for a changing economy, one with our big platforms. So she became famous by writing an article very critical of Amazon's market power. And she just said, listen, this old regime doesn't work anymore for these platform businesses. And a platform just means you have two sides of sellers and buyers, right? So she just didn't think that's a good fit. And so the rise of tech and the revisiting of these ideas that a lot of us thought were pretty firmly established for decades kind of collided here, and she's made a very successful career. She's wasn't in law school too long ago, and has had very prestigious positions around Washington and at law schools. And she was confirmed to be a member of the FTC, and strangely, you know, I think the same day was promoted to be the chair, which is not normally how it's done. But she was skyrocketing to the top, so we'll just write it off as that.
So we'll talk about some specific cases, which will elucidate the different approaches and the principles here. But just kind of a big question before we do that. So is it the case in your view that, you know, Amazon can be really big and can engage in anti-competitive practices that aren't actually harming consumers, but that's still bad, one, and two, could have downside for consumers in the future, such that you'd want to be concerned about that, even though the prices are going down for consumers and the convenience is higher and the experience is great and it's very popular? Could there still be a case that just because of its inherent market power, even if it's not currently hurting consumers, it could in the future?
Yeah, so I think in order for that scenario to play out where, okay, well, everything's great now and they're innovating with new services and they're keeping your prices low and your selection's huge. But
just all those things.
Let's put all that aside.
Right.
What if they just decided to hike up the prices one day and take it all away? And I think the economic literature on that says that that only works if you have a barrier to entry, right? That only works if someone else isn't out there with capital to come and say, ooh, I see an opportunity to come in and undercut Amazon. So I think as long as you don't have those barriers to entry in place, I think that they labor under the threat of that enough that it prevents it from happening. And that, you know, that's not always perfect, but I think it works a lot better than most clumsy government antitrust enforcement. How about that?
Yeah. So here we have this different understanding of antitrust, Lina Khan rocketing to the top of the FTC. And what in the broadest gauge have they been up to in doing with this new understanding and the power they have?
They have really been shaking it up over there. I won't bore our gentle listeners with all the internal strife at the FTC, but suffice it to say, career staff, all-time unhappy, lots of departures from people who've worked there for a long time, very unpopular in that way. And they've also kind of just been tossing over the norms. I mean, these agencies, I think, aren't something most people have a lot of exposure to, but there are career staff there that work through whatever administration comes through. They take their jobs very seriously, and there are social norms that, you know, and they're proud of the work they do. And she came in kind of guns blazing and said, you know, it's been a failure here for 40 years, and she concentrated a lot of power in her leadership office. The two Republicans that were on the commission have since resigned, one rather loudly, objecting in the pages of the Wall Street Journal to how the agency was being run. So internally, I think it's an agency that's troubled right now. And there's, of course, always some change when the leader changes and the administration changes. But I would venture to say that this is unprecedented in the scope and tenor of its change. And as far as cases, you know, Amazon's a great example, right, where under the consumer welfare standard, I don't know that you'd have much of a case. Amazon consistently polls as one of the most trusted brands in America. You know, tens and maybe hundreds of millions of people are subscribers, use it. There's Prime. People love it. Prices are down. Selection's up. Like, these are not terribly normal issues to bring an antitrust charge. And what's interesting about Amazon, too, is if you'll think back to years ago when Walmart was becoming the behemoth that it is, it kind of got away with skirting the antitrust scrutiny, I think because it was mostly sort of in flyover areas where the DC elite weren't noticing it happening. But the big criticism of them was that they were really killing Main Street businesses. They were hurting mm-hmm. small businesses.
Very much kind of the AP critique that you were, the AMP critique
yeah.
that you were
near. Yeah, exactly. And there weren't formal charges, but that was the critique of the company. And I think that's what worried some people with the same instincts. But what's interesting about Amazon is that small business retail has been thriving because of Amazon. Now you have all these businesses that kind of, they do their thing, but they use the delivery services of Amazon, the promotional services of Amazon, to kind of almost co-opt like a big company's services, but they still get to do their own, you know, little weird thing that they're doing,
and sell it through Amazon.
Yeah, the third party marketplace is wildly successful for Amazon, and it's wildly successful for those third parties. So you kind of have a situation where the marketplace has provided a nice solution yeah. to this concern, and it still didn't stop the FTC for going after Amazon. You know, and that case is weird because they kind of, when it all shakes out, what they're really saying is they really don't like the terms that Amazon is making with these third-party sellers. But, you know, of yeah. course, those are just kind of business decisions that are usually left best to those businesses.
So let's bracket Amazon just for one second. So I just want to, can you give us some idea of just the general sweep of the FTC actions and how they're going after the big and the small and the in-between. I have a friend who is heading a defense contractor type company, you know, successful company, but not a huge concern. Classic case of a startup that wants to sell itself and was selling itself to also not, you know, a bigger company, but not a huge one. And they're in court, I don't know, 2 years fighting the FTC to get this thing approved, which they finally did. You know, the judge was fairly, as I understand it, kind of contemptuous at the end of the day of this case against them. But it was an enormous drag in terms of time and resources to get something through that there was just no way it possibly. There are a lot of defense contractors, you know, they weren't Boeing or anything like that, but they were still dragged through this by the FTC.
Yeah, so I think a couple things there. The FTC issued new merger guidelines. So this is just, you know, they're not law, but they're supposed to be, if you're a company thinking about merging or acquiring, or maybe you're a practitioner of law that helps with that, this is like a general guideline for like, here's some things that might make the FTC worry, and here's some things that won't. So they issued a new version, and it is wildly permissive for the FTC to go after more and more deals. And it's frankly not going to be very useful, because in one of the footnotes, it basically is like, and, you know, whatever else we want to, because any amount of concentration is worrisome to them. So you're seeing more and more companies that you kind of shake your head at and think, well, what's the problem mm-hmm. here being pursued? And I think that's part of a larger sort of non-officially legally policy of going around, well, we don't need new legislation because that had failed a couple years ago on the Hill, and we don't even need court wins, but we're going to make this so expensive and difficult for you to try to merge or acquire right. or be yep. sold that a certain amount of deals are just going to be deterred, right? Yep. People are just going to say, forget yeah. it, we'll wait it out, maybe there'll be a new administration, mm-hmm. it's not worth it, what if it doesn't work? So I think in that weird way, it's very successful for their goals, right? They are probably deterring a certain amount of business. But it's certainly not good for the U.S. economy, because those efficiencies aren't happening, and it's not good for consumers who enjoy those efficiencies as new products, new services, and oftentimes lower prices. So, yeah. You know, I think she's doing what she can there. She's lost a lot of cases in court, but she can still kind of muck up the regulatory red tape, and I think she's doing that pretty effectively.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get to some specific cases, and we'll go back to Amazon since we've been discussing a little bit already. So we had a conservative Republican come in for an editorial meeting not too long ago, and he was supporting this. There was some bill. I forget what it was, but it was targeting tech companies, and he was just adamant, you know, a reasonable guy, someone I agree with, you know, on 99% of things, that Amazon is totally unfair and how it treats competitors. You know, I can't remember the specifics, Jessica, but it's the kind of thing like, you know, you come on to sell Frisbees that have some aspect that consumers find appealing. And lo and behold, Amazon's now in the Frisbee business and you know, it's taking your design and bumping you down and where you can be seen when you search for Frisbees. Instead, the Amazon thing comes up. And so things of that nature. So what is the FTC, what are they going after Amazon on specifically? And is there any kind of sharp practices that Amazon's engaged in that we should be concerned about?
Well, I don't doubt at all that Amazon has sharp elbows. You know, that's, but to me, you know, using the Frisbee example, because it's fun, you know, what that means for me as a consumer is one more possibly lower price Frisbee. And that doesn't keep me up at night. Now, it's a bummer if you're selling your Frisbees, but also there's lots of other places you could sell your Frisbees. And I think the vast majority of people selling on there find it incredibly beneficial. But, you know, they do offer their own version of things. And whether they pull that from the data of what's selling, I don't know. But I also think it's data that's on their platform. Why wouldn't they? And that was in one of the bills that failed to pass the House, that Lina Khan was a staffer on that committee saying, no, you know, it was kind of around self-preferencing and saying, you know, Amazon can't put its batteries up before the link to Duracell batteries. I mean, that's crazy, but it's really not that crazy if you need cheap batteries, right? I mean, That's the bottom line. Like, I get that Duracell might not be happy. And I'm putting words in Duracell's mouth. I haven't heard from them. But
no offense to Duracell.
No offense to Duracell. Not to drag you fine people into this.
Yeah. But the our ad guy, as we speak, is probably working on getting a Duracell sponsorship. And so don't blow it for us, Jessica.
I know. Sorry. I'm always a problem with these things. But, you know, that comes back to the consumer welfare being at the heart of these questions, right? And you see with the Amazon case that the FTC is hedging that a little and saying, well, I know, but what about these sellers? And they're kind of competing if they sell batteries too, and shouldn't we be worried about that? And for a lot of us, it's like, no, because we settled that 40 years ago and it was a mess. You know, if you're going to go after Wonder Bread for selling bread too cheap, what's the solution? Well, you're going to have to force Wonder Bread to raise its prices to the artisan bread levels. That's great for the artisan bread makers. It's not good for consumers. And frankly, that's the worst for poor consumers. Right, it's not a very egalitarian policy to say we're going to favor small businesses when oftentimes they cost more or less convenient. It should be a smattering of lots of things available to consumers, and cheap bread and Amazon batteries, I'm all for being on the list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love Wonder Bread, by the way. But my theory, especially when you're using bread for a sandwich, it should have no flavor whatsoever to distract.
I like the squishability as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Very important.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have a lot in common, Jessica. I can tell.
You and I are in accord.
By the end of this podcast, if we're not already. So where does the Amazon thing stand then?
It won't be resolved for quite some time, but we've seen arguments. And we'll see. I mean, they really haven't gone into specifically the FTC what they want as a remedy. I suppose it's possible that they would want Amazon to spin off its delivery service. They are very concerned about that, even though that's optional for third-party sellers. And most people find it quite convenient to leave all that to Amazon trucks and get back to making their product. But they're worried about that kind of vertical integration, which, you know, the vertical integration had just become completely non-controversial in antitrust circles because it provided efficiencies and it got rid of double margins, which means if you're not paying as a consumer, if you're not paying for a little markup so everyone can get paid, you're paying at one fewer level, that's a better price for you. So that's a pretty well-established economic principle. And you see in this case how the FTC has kind of started to throw out some of that economics and is going a little bit more on the, forgive me for using the term, the feels. Mm-hmm. You know, that feels mean.
So what is vertical integration? It's like when we control each aspect of the...
Yeah, so you're doing it down your supply chain of what you deliver, right? So instead of, horizontal mergers would be one competitor buying another competitor. And there's downward pressure on prices in that, and there's upward pressure on prices in that. So the antitrust regulators have said, well, we kind of have to take a look at that, you know, back during our 40 years of glory. We kind of have to take a look at each case and see what's going to happen here, what's going to happen for consumers. Mm-hmm. But vertical mergers, we'd pretty much agreed, usually just eliminate that double profit margin and probably make for a more efficient product or service and probably benefit consumers. So, you know, there weren't a lot of vertical mergers challenged, but to give you an example of a particularly wild one isn't talked about as much, but I think it's really an insight into how strong the ideology is with this group at the FTC. It's the Illumina-Grail merger. And that was a medical company buying another company that had an early detection cancer blood test. So it detected hundreds of kinds of cancer, 200 of which I think there aren't other tests for. And it would have been a real game changer for a lot of people. And the FTC eventually successfully blocked it and said it was uncomfortable with Illumina purchasing Grail because maybe in the future, in a market that doesn't exist yet, because Grail doesn't have any competitors yet, Illumina might be mean to those competitors about using its services and favor Grail. That's wild because in the meantime, people are going to die for not having this cancer test. And they still were like, no, but we're worried about this future market one day. And the idea that you would protect a future market that may or may never even exist, who knows what will change, that you do that over saving people's lives is a commitment to ideology that even I do not possess. And I am pretty hardcore free market kind of gal. But I think I was shocked about that. So, you know, that's an example of how you know, this is all very inside DC until it affects everyone's wallet or medical condition, right? And there's real consequences to getting in the way of innovation in this country.
Yeah, so sticking on the grocery store theme that's been a thread throughout this episode, Albertsons, Kroger's attempted merger is another contested area.
Yeah, and that one's wild because one of the things you're supposed to do in traditional antitrust litigation is you have to first prove that something is like rises to the level of monopoly. And in order to say someone is monopolizing a market, you have to define what that market is, right? You have to say, well, what is a substitute for this and who are the competitors and what's the scope of this? And in the FTC's defining of what this market is, they have sort of left out online grocery shopping, dollar stores, big club discounts like Costco, those things. So that means if you, you know, if you define a market down narrowly enough, you can make anything a monopoly. Like I always say, McDonald's has a monopoly on like the Big Mac, right? Mm-hmm. But there's obviously, well, what if you like pull it back and say hamburgers? What if you pull it back and say any kind of sandwich or anything you could have for lunch? That it's a little harder to make that case. And I think that's a little bit of what we see here, that they're putting up these numbers like, oh, they're going to control whatever percentage of groceries. Yeah, after you pretend like dollar stores aren't opening like crazy for people's grocery needs, and that Costco doesn't exist, and that Amazon hasn't made Whole Foods home delivery and all these curbs, you know, this is a very competitive market is the point. Curbside delivery, home delivery, all these new options. So to say, you know, really what's happening is that Kroger and Albertsons are having to combine to compete with, you know, I mean, Walmart alone having a grocery store in so many of its stores is just a huge influx of competition. So these more traditional grocery retailers need to combine efforts in order to compete. So, you know, those are things that we should be glad about as consumers, that the market is signaling them to get bigger and better. But instead, we're stopping that. And you know, I think the JetBlue Spirit Airlines recent block, that was DOJ. But the point is, those were two airlines that were struggling, wanted to combine resources to be able to compete with the big carriers. And now one's headed for bankruptcy court because it was blocked. And, you know, there just has to be a little bit of humility from these regulators to say, you know, maybe I don't know what's best, not just for every consumer, but for what companies need to do in order to be competitive. You should at least be asking yourself that question and not just saying, you're big, I don't like it, I say no.
So are Albertsons and Kroger's big? I don't, maybe it's a regional thing. I don't even see them around where I am in the world.
Yeah, it is a regional thing. They're big. You know, they're not big compared to Walmart and Amazon, who also offer groceries. But they're enough of a concern. And I think that one's interesting because the FTC's concerns seem to be about the labor effects, which, again, is not a traditional concern with antitrust. And also, these grocery stores have made a lot of assurances that they actually won't be cutting jobs in the affected areas. But that won't be enough for the FTC, if history is any indicator. But, you know, the bottom line is that everyone's a grocery consumer. That's why we have the Consumer Welfare Standard, because everyone's a consumer and is represented roughly fairly in that way. But not everyone is a member of labor at a grocery store. So you kind of move into this area where you're almost favoring a special interest group. And whether you're for that group or not is one thing, but that's certainly not what objective good law should do.
Yeah. So how about Capital One Discover, another case where these are not behemoths and are actually trying to compete against bigger companies?
Yeah. So this is another kind of, I think of it as a vertical merger. Capital One is a bank and they issue credit card, but they have to use the services of the big other credit card companies for those transactions. So this would be a way that they could obtain Discover and have that payment process system and offer both those services in an integrated way. And that would be really healthy competition probably for Visa and MasterCard. Those are the two biggies. So we see in this way that even though, you know, it's a combination and they're relatively big businesses, big isn't bad in this way because what you're producing is more competition for the biggest. And that's really what keeps the market healthy.
Right. So We'll get into a little bit what you guys are doing specifically to fight this and what a better approach might be and how we can get to that. But just net, what's your assessment on whether, let's for the lack of a better phrase, or maybe there's a better phrase, but I'm going to use this one anyway. How successful has the LenaCon project been so far? We talked about the chilling effect. There's really nothing you can do about that. But is the FTC succeeding or failing more in court, and just how has it been going?
It's not been going great for them in court. There's some wins they can point to, but I think mostly they have the loss category is winning there for them. And they've been weird about that. When asked about it, they've said, well, you know, winning cases isn't everything.
All right.
I would disagree
with that.
What
you said, you're losing cases.
Yeah, losing cases is somehow winning is, that's going to be a bridge too far for me. But like you said, I do think it's having a chilling effect on people's attempts to merge. And I think by their standards, that would be a win. And I also think that by breaking all of these norms, that could mean one of two things. One is we've really unleashed regulators in a way that is not going to serve us well, right? No matter what side you're on politically, you won't like it when the other guy gets in there and just lets it rip. That's not good for the economy. That's not good for any of us. But the flip side of that is that they really are out over their skis. And this is a time when the Supreme Court specifically, but certainly lower courts, have grown increasingly intolerant of regulatory overreach. The major doctrines question is one that's being considered. And there's also a suit actually filed by Meta challenging the constitutionality of the FTC's in-house administrative court. So inside of the FTC, they have their like own little mini court with their own little mini judges. And if you don't like what happens to you in that court as a business, you can go take it to a real Article III court. But I think the question Meta is posing is, why does this even exist? Why don't we just put everything in an Article III court? Which is why I think generally the DOJ does a better and more constitutional job with antitrust, because they're not acting as prosecutor and jury and judge. They're just taking it to a real court and seeing what happens. And at the FTC, there's a delay in that. So I think that a lot of the power that the FTC is trying to expand could be rather violently revoked by just pushing it too far too fast.
Mm-hmm. And so what are you guys doing specifically to focus on this area?
We're talking about it ad nauseum, as you have been a victim of today. we're boring everyone with this, trust me, it's important and you should care, message that the FTC overreach is not normal, not healthy, not good for consumers, not good for American businesses. And we have a website, Eye on FTC, which no one will get my reference to Eye on LA, which was a weird local show when I was growing up in Southern California that would like show cool things that you were supposed to be doing that weekend with people in 80s outfits at the beach. And it would make you feel bad about yourself for kind of being a dork at home watching TV. But I digress. Eye on FTC is a clearinghouse for everyone who's writing on these issues. So our work's there, but the work of people around different policy groups around DC, news stories, whatever. I really want it to be a resource for anyone who, for whatever reason, needs to know about this stuff, is interested in it. So we're certainly doing that beyond just the regular beating of the drum think tank style that we do.
So do we just need to wait for another administration? And this is sort of like, unfortunately, how other areas of the law work. You know, you want new environmental regulations. Congress doesn't do anything. You know, you just have a new administration and they kind of rewrite it in effect unilaterally on their own. Or there are other things that Congress or others can be doing to nudge us in the right direction.
Well, I always hesitate to say Congress could, because not sure what Congress can do anymore. But certainly, less funding to the agency would be helpful immediately. I don't know if they're going to fund anything, but that would be helpful. I do think a shift in administration would change things. But you know, with whose administrations we're talking about, I'm not quite sure. One of the interesting things about this neo-Brandeisian movement from the left is that it, in a lot of ways, lines up pretty well with some populists on the right. So I'm not sure what a Trump FTC would would do with all of this new precedent and behavior. That's unclear. I mean, if, you know, if Barry Goldwater's administration was coming in, I'd have a better answer for you. But
So what do you make of that case from the right, which is both based on the idea that big is bad, kind of very similar idea, but also that these are people, especially in the tech realm, that hate us, you know, and that are destroying America and producing products that are bad for America. So forget you, Bob Bork, you know, you didn't know what time it was. It's not 50 years ago. We need to go after these people with the power we have once we retake it, or if we retake it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think that a lot of that animosity towards tech from the right actually stems from more like social issues than political ones, but politically retaliating seems to be what's available to them. You know, I think that a lot of the tech stuff was caught up in a lot of larger issues that really aren't tech specific, right? There's a lot of wokeness that's happening all over. It's not just in tech, but this seems to be a handy target. And of course, the presumed involvement of tech's influence on elections, pick your election and pick your different party, I think has also turned up the heat on all of that. But, you know, for me, I guess there's just, again, I go back to this, there just has to be some humility in lawmaking and regulating that says, I might not have all the answers for everyone. Let's set out some good rules and maximize liberty here in terms of economic liberty and personal liberty, in my opinion. And I think there's, instead of that, from the right, there's a lot more sort of like revenge. And I think a lot of it is very sincere. Like there's a fear that we're losing something, we're missing something, something's being degraded. And, you know, I would argue that solution comes from the bottom up, in persuading people and changing people's minds about things and what they can do in their own sphere of influence is probably a much more powerful message. But, you know, that's not going to get you on cable news tonight. So if you go in swinging after Mark Zuckerberg, that's probably going to be a lot more popular and interesting for people to watch you do than my, like, go be a good person and do the right thing nonsense. Yeah. That, you know, nobody wants that.
I'll just throw this general impression at you and let you react before we conclude. So it is, you know, going back to grocery stores, like I wouldn't even know now what the biggest grocery stores are. You know, I'm not the biggest grocery shopper in our family, but I drive
except
around as a grocery
bread.
Store. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, my wife likes shopping places where there isn't good white bread.
Oh,
you know, it certainly isn't Wonder Bread. But I would, you know, things are so disaggregated. A lot of things, I just don't know what the biggest ones are anymore, except I know Amazon's the biggest online retailer. I know Google is the biggest search service. Apple, you know, biggest device seller. So it seems like that's the area where that has bucked this general trend towards disaggregation. Am I right about that? And two, is that at all concerning in and of itself?
I think you're right about that. But I will say that the advertising that Google provides, it's almost, to so many small businesses, is a decentralizing force as well. It's and the same with Amazon for third-party sellers, and the same with a lot of these platforms. The platform itself is big, but the smaller companies that benefit from the use of that portion of it, right, who benefit from the scope and the efficiencies, I think that's a more decentralized part of the economy that you maybe, I don't mean you, any of us, wouldn't be as aware of if you weren't you know, someone paid to sit in an office like I am and think about it. So I think there's cross currents at work there, right? You're right. Those are the biggies in those areas. But I would also point out that, you know, what these companies have a monopoly in terms of market share, I do think was legally acquired. And I do think isn't all that, you know, they compete against each other in a lot of this too. Google competes fiercely with Meta on advertising, as they do with Amazon. There's a lot of kind of coming and going out of these areas that I think is really healthy. And I will point to, you know, before the pandemic, no one ever heard of Zoom, and now Zoom is a household name. TikTok, we don't have to talk about that today, but I will say it did kind of shoot to the top of the list, whatever your problems are with TikTok aside. It does show that in social media, there's certainly a lot of room for competition. So I just think we're still at the stage where, you know, Google does search really, really well. Amazon does Amazon really, really well. And it doesn't mean that you can't go to Costco or Walmart to get your stuff, but it does mean that you might get it the same day at Amazon and get to pick from, you know, every product in the world. And that's pretty cool. So I just don't think, you know, these are huge companies. The dollar values are amazing and their scope is amazing. But they do generally pretty amazing things, whether or not you like their politics. That's one thing. But they do a pretty good job for consumers. And I do think that there aren't any barriers to entry for the next, you know, big thing that's going to come along and clock them. I mean, for Google search, that's going to be AI. You know, they have an AI problem there that they're going to have to get under control if they want to stay in the lead of search.
All right. Well, that's it for us. You've been listening to a special sponsored edition of The Editors. Our regularly scheduled programming will return soon. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes it sound better than we deserve. Thanks to Jessica Malugin and CEI, and thanks especially to all of you for listening to The Editors. And we'll see you next time.